This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Why is religion still around in the 21st century? Why look to ancient texts, beliefs, and practices in an age when scientists have made so many breakthroughs about the nature and origin of the universe? These are questions religion scholar Elaine Pagels has spent a lot of time thinking about. The questions became deeply personal during a long period of grieving. Her life was shattered by the death of her son Mark at the age of 6 and a half, following a long illness. In 1988, just over a year after what she thought was the worst loss she could imagine, her husband Heinz Pagels, a theoretical physicist and the executive director of the New York Academy of Sciences, died in a mountain climbing accident. Her new book, Why Religion, A Personal Story, combines memoir and biblical scholarship to reflect on how she found faith and lost it, but turned to ancient Jewish and Christian texts and the meditation she was taught by Trappist monks to comprehend her feelings of guilt, anger, and unceasing grief, and to try to survive long enough to move beyond it. Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University and is best known for her writings on the Gnostic Gospels, the Christian texts that were omitted from the canon because they were considered heretical. Elaine Pagels, welcome to Fresh Air. So your book is in part about the search for meaning when you're suffering. And as you point out, you're a historian of religion. You look up at how cultures have dealt with things like suffering and loss. But could you turn to a specific religion for the things you needed when you lost your son and then your husband?
At the time of mourning, I couldn't look to anything very much that was a tradition like that. They seemed quite remote. What I could turn to were friends and music and nature and eventually look at the traditions that are most familiar to me, which are Jewish, Christian, and Buddhist, now that I'm teaching a class on Buddhism with a colleague whose specialty is Tibetan Buddhism.
You write, many of us have left religious institutions behind and prefer to identify as spiritual, not religious. You say, I've done both, had faith and lost it, joined groups and left them. To my own surprise, yes. I went back, wanting to understand what happened and to explore the stories, poetry, music, and art that make up religious traditions. You grew up in a secular family, and you write, religion actually made your father angry. Why?
Yes, it made him angry because he'd been raised by fiercely Presbyterian parents who apparently talked a great deal about hell and damnation, and he wanted to get out of that as soon as he could. So when he heard about Darwin, he just abandoned the whole ship and said, that's for people who aren't educated, not people like us. So he wanted to distance himself from that, became a scientist, and said, this is the way to find truth.
Did you grow up a skeptic about religion?
I didn't grow up a skeptic. The family was culturally Protestant. So sometimes my mother took us to a Methodist church, which seemed to me well-meaning and basically fairly boring, that particular church. And it didn't have an enormous impact. What I find now is that these traditions, these powerful thousand-year-old traditions, multi-thousands of years, are very deep and they appeal to us very viscerally. And when they do, they're quite extraordinary. When I first experienced it like that, I thought, that's astonishing, and fell into it. But I didn't want to be simply captured by the emotional intensity of that experience, because that can trap you into a particular, shall we say, ideology that I found too confining.
Well, you were born again at the age of 15 after some friends convinced you, you were living in Palo Alto, and some friends convinced you to go to San Francisco with them to hear Billy Graham as part of his crusade for Christ. What year do you think that was?
That was marvelous. It was at the end of the 50s, I think, when mm-hmm. I was a teenager. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I just thought it might be interesting. And I found it enormously powerful. And that was a big surprise. And of course, as you say, it really made my parents horrified when they heard that I'd actually jumped right in.
You joined the other side.
Well, born again, I mean, that was probably their worst nightmare, evangelical Christianity. What I realize is that there's a great deal of power in that kind of conviction that Billy Graham expressed that was articulated through the music. There were 18,000 people in Candlestick Park, which is a sports arena. It was an overpowering experience. And Billy Graham, to my surprise, was talking about the United States in a way that I'd never heard. So that struck me deeply.
What did he say that struck you like that?
Well, first of all, he said that what he preached was going to be sound very strange to intellectuals and academics. And that's the world I grew up in because my father was in that world. And it really did. He, first of all, denounced America for driving its most brilliant sons, of course, then he only thought of men doing this, into the sciences to build bigger nuclear weapons. And this is only decades after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I was stunned because I had been brought up to think, well, you know, science is the way to find, you know, understanding. And America is the gold standard of moral rightness. And to hear him talk about America, about nuclear weapons used against the Japanese, about slavery and segregation, I was totally hooked because I'd never heard anyone speak that way, and it sounded accurate.
And were there spiritual things that he said that spoke to you as well?
Yes, he also appealed completely to somebody who just turned 15. He said, now you can have a new life. You can be born again. You can break out of the confines of the world you live in. For me, that was suburban Palo Alto, and sort of break into a new universe, a much larger canvas, and, you know, find a new family. And I thought, wow, that was an irresistible invitation.
So, you know, it's interesting that death tested your faith pretty soon. You know, you were looking to art and music and poetry for a sense of larger meaning, too. And
yes,
a good friend of yours named Paul was a painter, and he taught you about painting, and you were very close. And then he was killed in a car crash. He was a passenger,
yes,
in the car. And that tested your faith because of things that your fellow Christian friends said to you. What were some of those things?
Well, it wasn't even that tested my faith. It, whatever that meant. I went back to my evangelical friends. My friend Paul, who was killed, was 16 in high school. And when I went back to the evangelical church, my friends were very sympathetic, and they said, oh, that's terrible. Was he born again? And I said, no, he was Jewish. And then they looked at me stunned and said, well, then he's in hell. And I thought, what? That has nothing to do with what attracted me to this kind of community, this kind of conviction. God loves you, all of that. It has nothing to do with that. It's antithetical. And I felt completely alone, walked out of there, and never went back.
Did you want to find another church after that, or did you just give up?
No. No, because I felt that they were all selling different brands of a certain product, which could get caught in particular shapes, and that they wanted to sort of force people to think a certain way. And I was not having it that time, Terry.
So yeah. A little detour here, because this is the part of your story that intersects with Jerry Garcia. And I thought, what, Elaine Pagels knew Jerry Garcia before he was in The Grateful Dead? That just kind of shocked me. So was he in that car accident?
Yes. He had been in Palo Alto playing music, hanging out at various places, Ken Kesey's house up in Los Trancos Woods, and in town. And he was older than the rest of us, but those of us in high school who knew that group were fascinated. He was a brilliant guitarist, and he taught us all kinds of music we never heard of. So I didn't know him very closely, but he was very much a part of that group. When Paul, my friend, was killed in a car crash, it was coming from a party where Jerry and Alan Trist, who was later his business manager, were in the car, as well as two other people. And Jerry was actually thrown out of the windshield. And Alan, I think, broke his back, or he had a terrible accident. And so we became, after that, rather close friends because we spent time together after the accident with a couple of other friends who had known each other before.
You speculate in the book that the Grateful Dead was named in part because he survived this car crash and, you know, Paul did not. Do you have any evidence that that really was the source of the name of the band?
Yes, I did speculate that. It seemed obvious to me. And then later I read something about it. I didn't see him after that. I mean, after he formed the group, that was years later. But I saw in a biography about the group that he said that accident woke him up and made him realize he didn't have endless time and he had to get serious. And so the name of the group, as I understand it, came from that accident.
My guest is Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the new book, Why Religion? A Personal Story. We'll talk more after a break, and Ken Tucker will review a new album by the country trio Pistol Annies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Elaine Pagels, a professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the new book, Why Religion? A Personal Story. It's about the death of her son Mark at the age of 6 and the death of her husband Heinz about a year later. To comprehend and survive the magnitude of her grief, she meditated in the style she was taught by Trappist monks and turned to the ancient Hebrew and Christian texts she studies, including the Gnostic Gospels, the texts considered too heretical for inclusion in the Christian canon. One of her previous books was a bestseller devoted to the Gnostic Gospels. So a question that you've always had, and this question kind of resounds throughout your book, is why does religion continue to exist? With all we know about science now, why does religion exist? And what do we want from it? It's not a question that you can answer in the course of an interview, but along those same lines, you know, you're a historian of religion, so whether you practice a specific religion or not, you are immersed in the texts of Judaism, Christianity. Now you're teaching Buddhism as well.
Well, I'm co-teaching.
Co-teaching it, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't teach it alone.
Yeah, your late husband, Heinz Pagels, was a theoretical physicist and studied chaos theory. Can you talk about some of the similarities and differences between how you approached similar questions about the workings of the world and finding meaning in life? Him from his point of view as a theoretical physicist studying chaos theory, and you from your point of view studying the great religious texts. Or at least some of the great religious texts.
The question I started asking after I'd left that church for years, I thought there's something powerful there. That what was it? Was it about Christianity? Was it about religion? What was it? Part of it, Terry, was a kind of emotionally charged, imaginative language that is spoken in these traditions, you know, and was not really spoken in my home. It was also based on the assumption that science was somehow equivalent to religion. Years later, when I met Heinz, he said to me, "Why religion? Why do you do something that has no impact in the real world?" And I said, "Well, why do you do elementary particles?" And we sort of laughed and argued and realized that we were both looking for some fundamental way of understanding our experience. And what I came to see, living with this wonderful scientist and wonderful man, is that he understood that physics does not answer metaphysical questions. And religions are a different kind of paradigm, an imaginative paradigm that talks about meaning in ways that scientists don't and can't. And so these are complementary. I came to understand that. And that's one of the reasons that the religious traditions aren't obsolete.
You and your husband had a baby after trying to conceive and then fertility treatment. So you gave birth to a son, but he was born with a serious heart problem that would require surgery after he reached the age of 1 and was strong enough to endure the surgery. The surgery seemed to go okay, but you later discovered that he had another fatal problem, pulmonary hypertension. You were told that that was fatal, that it would eventually, sooner or later lead to an early death. Your son died when he was 6 and a half. So for 6 and a half years, you loved your son knowing that he wouldn't live long. And instead of planning for his future, when you looked into the future, you saw his death. And when he died, you felt guilty, even though it sounds like you did everything to give him the maximum amount of love and care. Why do you think you felt guilty?
That's a good question. Because parents who are given a very difficult diagnosis about a child will do anything. And also, physicians will do anything. They go to extreme lengths to deal with trying to treat a child with that kind of thing. And yet, what I was reading at the time, I felt just in agony, of course, about this, because it matters more to a parent than our own lives, you know, that our children survive. And yet there was nothing we could do. That sense of helplessness was almost intolerable. And I realized that I felt guilty about it. And yet, at a certain critical point in my son's treatment, I realized that the guilt was only masking something much deeper and much more painful than guilt. And what it was masking was the fact that we were helpless, that there was nothing we could do. We had no input. As long as I felt guilty, I felt, well, at least it's my fault, or I have some agency in something that matters more to me than my own life. But if I have no agency, I mean, that's almost intolerable. And I realized that I'd rather feel guilty than helpless. It's a choice I made unconsciously, and I think many people do, because the feeling that we can't do anything and we have no input is more than we can bear.
After your son died, some people said to you, your faith must have sustained you. What was your reaction when people said that to you?
When people said that, I thought, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never felt further than anything they were calling faith than at a time of intense grief. That felt extremely remote to me. And I did wonder, you know, how can one go through this? How can one survive it? I wasn't certain that I could at all.
In the story of Jesus, you know, the story is that God sacrificed the life of his son. So you put that in your words.
Well, I remember after our son died, I went to the Church of the Heavenly Rest in New York to talk to people there about the service that we would have. And I heard somebody preparing for Easter, it was right before Easter, talking about God so loved the world that he gave his only son to save the world from sin or something. And I just thought, any God who did that would have to be crazy. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Our only son had just died. How could one do that for any reason? Now, I understand why it's said historically. I understand how it was put together that way. But it struck me as dissonant that this was somehow a sacrifice and something that would have been willed. What I found later in one of the secret texts from the discoveries in Upper Egypt with the Gospel of Thomas was a text called the Gospel of Truth. And that one has a very different perspective. It doesn't see suffering as sort of ennobling, as teaching you something, as deepening your faith. I don't like to say good things about suffering. I don't like suffering. It's very painful. But this other text talks about suffering not as if it were some kind of wonderful state that can teach you a spiritual lesson. I think that kind of piety is very much overrated. Certainly it would have been for me. But rather this spoke about the fact that when people suffer, there is a potential in that dreadful complex of experiences of grief to open up to other people in a deeper way, that it can demonstrate our connection with all other people. And for me, that feels accurate. And I'm grateful for that.
Did you have the sense that, like, after you lost your son when he was 6 and a half, after he died from an illness, that you would be kind of immune because, like, you were given, like, the horror that you had to suffer through, and now you could like move on and face the future with a constant sense of grief, but still, did you have the sense of like you were done? You had been afflicted, and lightning wasn't going to strike twice, because it did strike twice. Like your husband died in a mountain climbing accident just slightly over a year after your son died.
Absolutely. After our son died, we felt that the worst thing we could imagine had happened. It was, the sword had fallen. Nothing worse could happen now. And so we went on with the two children we had. One was 3 months old and one was two. And nothing could happen, right? The horror was behind us. His accident was beyond any imagination. And that's when I thought, it's unimaginable. How can I possibly survive this?
You end your book with a Jewish prayer. Blessed art thou, Lord God of the universe, that you have brought us alive to see this day. What does that mean to you?
As I wrote, it's very surprising to me that long after these events happened, I feel alive and well. The children that I had to raise are alive and well, that people can recover from things that seemed impossible to recover from. I did see other people go into despair, and that for me seemed like a real possibility. I didn't want to go there. I wanted to find an alternative to that, to find a way to live with hope and joy and courage. And that prayer speaks to coming out of that kind of isolation and fear. It speaks about gratitude for how we get through things.
Well, Elaine Pagels, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reflecting so much about your life, your grief, the role of religion in your life as a scholar and just as a person. And thank you for writing your book.
Well, thank you. I've really loved talking with you about it.
Elaine Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University and author of the new book, Why Religion? A Personal Story. The Pistol Annies is a trio of three country music artists, Miranda Lambert, Ashley Monroe, and Angelina Presley. Each has a solo career, and Lambert is one of the biggest stars in country. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that when they get together as a group, their collaborations yield songs that aren't typical of any of them individually. Their new album is called Interstate Gospel. Here's Ken's review.
Jesus is the bread of life. Without him, you're toast. Hallelujah, y'all, I found the Holy Ghost. To be almost saved only means that you're lost. Sins are expensive and Jesus paid the cost.
The Pistol Annies could have been a vanity project, an indulgence for three pals with enough music industry clout to score a record deal. Instead, over the course of three albums since 2011, Miranda Lambert, Ashley Monroe, and Angelina Presley have turned the Pistol Annies into something special, a way to make strong music with a sense of humor, a sense of righteousness, and a sense of drama.
I picked a good day for recreational purposes. I've got an itch to just get high. I'm in the middle of the worst of it. These are the best years of my life. I've got the hankering for intellectual emptiness. I've got the need to ease my mind. I'll watch some reruns on the TV set. These are the best years of my life. I was looking forward to staying here forever, 'cause you asked me to. Didn't think that I could do better, so I settled down in this 10-cent town. It's about to break me. I'm gonna mix a drink and
That's Best Years of My Life, a lovely ballad with some sting in its tail. It recounts a day in the life of a woman who seems overwhelmed by work and responsibilities. reminding herself that these are the best years of her life is intended both as a reality check and an irony along the lines of, if these are the good times, why do I feel so bad? You don't hear country music about a woman drowning her depression in pills and booze very often. The Pistol Annies pursue their moods wherever they take them, as on this song about the lies women can tell themselves about marriage on When I Was His Wife.
He'd never cheat, he'd never lie, he'll love me forever till the day that we die. He'll never take me for granted, I said that too when I was his wife. Handsome in the bright morning light, his smile can light up your world for a while. His love is enough to keep me satisfied. Well, I said that too when I was his wife. When you're blinded by diamonds and driven by lust, honey, you can't build a mansion with a piece of sawdust.
In recent interviews, Lambert has taken to ticking off what she calls the Pistol Annie's stats. She says, we have two husbands, two ex-husbands, two babies, one on the way, and 25 animals. These women are also not above playing with whatever knowledge their fans might have of their personal lives. Lambert was in the tabloids when her marriage to country star Blake Shelton broke up a while back. That situation and other Annie's events are alluded to in this song, Got My Name Changed Back.
It takes a judge to get married, takes a judge to get divorced. Well, the last couple of years, spent a lot of time in court. Got my name changed back.
Yeah, yeah.
I got my name changed back.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I wanted something new, then I wanted what I had. I got my name changed back.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I got me an
ex. There's an impressive range of musical styles here, starting with the gospel of the title song. That last tune I just played is a throwback to the kind of twangy novelty songs country music produced in profusion in the 1970s. At other times, the Pistol Annies put their feminist stamp on the traditionally masculine outlaw country genre. The Annies' harmonies have been compared to the Andrews Sisters from the 1940s, even as they also make the sort of country pop that's very much in vogue these days. Then there's a song like Masterpiece, which is just a timeless torch song.
Baby, we were just a masterpiece.
Pistol Annies recently described some of their new songs as sounding, quote, a lot like dumping out a girl's purse. That's both a joke about their brand of brash confessionalism and a dead serious assertion that this kind of emotional spilling is art as sure as any country music being made right now.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Interstate Gospel by the Pistol Annies. Coming up, we talk with James Beard Award-winning chef Jose Andres about some of the imaginative, kind of crazy experiments he's done with food. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Back in September on Fresh Air Weekend, we featured an interview with Jose Andres, a celebrated chef and relief worker. We're going to hear an excerpt of the interview that we didn't have time for. This year, he received the James Beard Humanitarian of the Year Award for his work in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Andres and the groups he founded, World Central Kitchen and Chefs for Puerto Rico, prepared sandwiches and hot food for people throughout Puerto Rico, commandeering kitchens from restaurants, schools, and an arena. His book about that is called We Fed an Island. In 2011, Andres received the James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef of the Year. Among the things he's known for are his many restaurants, his creative food innovations, and helping popularize tapas in America. He grew up in Spain and came to the U.S. in 1991 after serving in the Spanish Navy. Jose Andres, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on all the work you've been doing. You grew up in Spain, and you started cooking with your father on open fires. Were those grills?
No, those were some rocks in the floor.
In the floor of your home?
No, in the middle of the mountain, in an open field, with a little kind of triangle, metal triangle, that will elevate the paella pan.
Mm-hmm.
And I will gather the wood, and I will make the fire. And my father will make this big paella, this amazing rice dish that is traditional from Valencia. And we will make a big pot of food. And sometimes we were 20, and sometimes we were 100. My father always said that, you know, if you have the big pot, the only thing you have to do to feed more people is throw a few more, handfuls of rice. And there you can feed anybody. And so that moment in my life was important for me.
So what did you learn about fire and cooking from those experiences?
Well, one day I wanted to do the cooking, and my father never let me. He only put me in charge of the fire. And one day I got very upset, and he sent me away. They finished the meal, but he came and he put me aside and he told me, my son, I know you wanted to do the cooking, but I had nobody else to do the fire. And actually the fire is the most important thing. If you do control the fire, then you can do any cooking you want. This is literally for cooking, but this cannot be applied to life. Sometimes we all only want to do the cooking, but we forgot what is the fire.
In Spain, you left school when you were 15. Was that high school that you dropped out of?
Yeah, but I barely made it. I mean, I barely went.
So it didn't mean much to drop out because you weren't going anyways.
Well, I was there the first year, kind of, but was already this cooking school that my father thought was the right fit for me. And quite frankly, I was helping my father and my mother at home since I was very young. And I always love food and love eating and love being in the kitchen. So for me, was a natural, you know. I always say I don't work. I do what I love. I love feeding people. I love cooking. And, you know, that's my life.
So what were the dishes that became the first dishes that were your specialty?
Well, I have so many different restaurants.
Yes, I know.
with so many different ethnic backgrounds,
uh-huh,
that, you know, I will say, for example, one dish that we are very known for, especially at the Bazaar in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles, is the Philly cheesesteak.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
I made the Philly cheesesteak first time in Minibar.
Philly. I'm the one who's in Philly here.
almost 15 years ago. And even I think the Philadelphia logo, the newspaper there, I think they brought even an editorial saying, who is this immigrant that dares to transform the Philly cheesesteak? And I think we did an amazing job. And I think it's what I took it to L.A. to be far away from Philadelphia, Taliban foodies that will crush this accent, Spaniard, English tongue from touching their sacred Philly cheesesteak. But we did a hollow kind of pita bread, very
light.
Wait.
Let's first describe what a Philly cheesesteak is. And it's on a long roll with very thinly sliced steak with either cheese or in some instances more like cheese whiz on top of it. And then, you know, whatever you want, like peppers or pickles or
onions,
you know, whatever.
So I did the same.
Uh-huh.
But.
Yeah.
The bread was long and crunchy.
It was crunchy?
But the bread was hollow inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a pita bread that is very thin and crunchy outside because we overcook it. And inside is totally hollow. It's empty.
So you're not filling up on the bread?
Well, you are not filling up on the bread, but the bread is sensational because it's light. And then because it's hollow, I'm able to put a cheese mousse, we call it cheese foam, that we make, which is warm, and it's unbelievable.
It's
and
not it's cheese like, whiz, right? This is like cheese mousse.
It's our cheese whiz.
Okay.
And we fill it up inside. And is the entire hollow bread is full of cheese, but the cheese is super light, but at the same time, full of flavor. And then we cut thin slices of beef. But the beef is kind of raw. It's just warming up with the help of the warmth of the cheese. And then we put an onion puree. And then sometimes we put a little bit of salt and a touch of olive oil. And then you bring that to your mouth. And it's light, almost like doesn't weight. But then you put it and it's like a cloud of Philly cheesesteak. And you bite into it and you have the flavor of the onion, the flavor of the meat, the flavor of the cheese, the crunchiness of the bread. And this is an homage to Philly. Even some people try to crucify me back in time when I did it. But I forgive them. I'm a guy that believes that food should unite people, not break people apart.
So let me ask you, if you're relying on hot cheese to actually cook the beef, how cooked is the beef?
No, it's rare. But you know, you have some people that like their beef well done and some people that like their beef rare. But believe me, everybody likes our Philly cheesesteak the way we do it. It's thinly sliced, almost like it was a carpaccio, and it's just put on top of the bread. And then we use a torch, but barely, used to warm it up.
A torch?
Yeah, a blowtorch. A touch, and we do oh my God, I cannot wait for you to eat this. Your life will change forever. I mean, your life literally will change forever. Well, one day we should go to the heart of Philly and do Philly cheesesteaks for everybody.
So what made you think that you should be redefining what a Philly cheesesteak is?
This is great. Why a real estate millionaire guy decided to run for president? I mean, that's what humans we are here for. This is not 1984. This is not let's all be dressed the same.
No,
I get that.
But were you in Philly and
yes,
ate a cheesesteak and thought like
this
could be better. I could do something different with this.
And this is what creativity is all about. Is what like when I went to meet Del Chihuly because I was fascinated with
his
work.
Glass sculpture.
And I did the entire menu inspiring his glass work, but using sugar and isomalt to recreate his pieces. And I spent a few days with him blowing glass. I broke a tooth in the process, and I made a few pieces with Del Chihuly as my master, as my mentor. And we did the entire menu inspired on his work.
Okay, wait.
That's what creativity is.
Right. So
creativity is when you sometimes do things only to bring another perspective into something.
So at the risk of making you persona non grata in Philadelphia, when you ate a Philadelphia cheesesteak in Philly, which I assume at some point you did, what was your critique of the cheesesteak?
Oh my God.
You may never come to the city again after this, but go ahead.
I thought that the quality of the bread was so-so, and I thought the quality of the meat, you know, poor meat. The meat didn't know who the meat was. They and I thought the onion was not cooked right, and I thought the green pepper was not done well. But then it's other chefs that do great Philly cheesesteak. But we're talking the vast majority. I wanted to do my homage to what has become a traditional American staple. But this is not any different than when we all have Thanksgiving. And you ask people, how was your turkey? And everybody, oh, it was so great. You're lying. The vast majority of the turkeys are overcooked, overdry, but what makes them unique is the people you ate them with, your family, your friends, the effort you put into making it great. That's what it's all about. Sometimes we need, though, to be pushing. And a chef has always to be pushing the envelope when we talk about food. In high-end restaurants, I did it with a Philly cheesesteak. But then we all should be always pushing the envelope. That's why humanity is so great.
So one of your restaurants now specializes in vegetables. Vegetables are at the center of the cuisine, not like a side dish. What do you love about cooking with vegetables?
I mean, vegetables are so sexy. I mean, listen to me. I love meat, right? And I love barbecue, and I love steak, and I love burgers. But think for a second. A piece of meat you put in your mouth, and you bite into it. The first 5 seconds, all the juices flow around your mouth. Your tongue is telling you, oh, my God, what's happening? It's too good. But then the juices go away, and you have a piece of ugly, I don't know how to describe it, that you have to be munching for the next 25 seconds so you can ingest and put it in your stomach. Why we go through so much suffering? Why? When you cut a piece of watermelon or a piece of pineapple, you put it in your mouth, it's fresh at the very beginning, it's crunchy, it's sweet. From the first second to the last second that is in your mouth, it's full of flavor, full of texture, full of different flowing juices around your mouth. That's worth munching, and that's worth eating. That's why vegetables, they need to be getting more respect.
One of the things that you do is molecular gastronomy, which is basically using scientific knowledge about food, understanding its chemical makeup, to make interesting tastes and dishes. So can you give us an example of something unusual that you've done because of your knowledge of the makeup of food that's like okay. Really tasty and a little weird?
Yeah, listen, we hate the name molecular gastronomy.
Or it sounds too laboratory.
Because a mad scientist in the lab.
Almost
is like people finger point at us in the old days. Oh, he's a molecular chef. Listen to me, people of America. Everything is molecular. When you drink wine, that's molecular. When you drink beer, that's molecular. When you eat cheese, that's molecular. When your food gets rotten, that's molecular. Your pickles, that's molecular. Everything is molecular. What has happened is that before we were clueless. We didn't know why things happen. We didn't know about Maillard reaction. We didn't know about mayonnaise emulsion, stable emulsions. Now, we know. Now, chefs like me, we created a class next to professors of physics at Harvard, which became one of the most popular undergrad classes at Harvard. Now we have knowledge, and knowledge makes you powerful. And thanks to the power, we are able to do, for example, mousse, that in the old days you will require heavy cream and meat fat. And now I can make the same mousse without any dairy, without any heavy cream, and only using the pure ingredient, like strawberries. We can make a mousse of a strawberry without the use of any butter or any fat. That's knowledge. That's what gives you the power to do better food, more tasty food, and that's the way forward. More knowledge in the hands of chefs and the people will help us to be feeding the world better every day.
But what's an example of something that you've done that's unusual because of your knowledge of the makeup of the food you were working with?
Well, for example, I'm going to tell you something like my team came up over the last few weeks and they were showing me all the results.
Great.
We bought a machine that we have in our Think Food Tank, our laboratory, and it's a freeze-drying machine. We began learning about freeze-dry foods for the astronauts and things like this. And freeze-dry is great because it brings any food down to a very cold freezing temperature. And in the process, you are extracting the humidity of that food that you are trying to freeze dry. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
So we got condensed milk. And we, pure condensed milk, the same condensed milk you can buy anywhere in a can. And we put it inside the machine. We put a dollop of only the condensed milk. But we never did it before. So we didn't know how, what was going to happen. In life, you have to be not afraid of failure to have successes. So we put it. And what happened is that it has so much sugar and the freeze drying and kind of the pressure that all of the sudden, instead of the dollop of condensed milk becoming smaller, it began growing and growing. And at the end, we have like a big balloon, like a thin skin of condensed milk, hollow inside, crunchy in the outside. And all of a sudden, we have a new thing. What are we going to do with that? I don't know. But we already created something like was not created before. We have like a condensed milk, crispy, crunchy balloon. The reasons
are... Does it taste good?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's going to change the condensed milk game. I'm telling you, we have a condensed milk game now. And so this is one of the things. You know, but remember, this is not strange. We are only using technology. It's not any different than frying. It's not any different than steaming. It's not any different than roasting. It's only one more technique. And having knowledge of techniques allows you to do more things. I guarantee you we're going to see more of those things in the years to come. And the good things will remain. And other things will only stay in the very high-end restaurants. But I love that new thing with condensed milk and other things. We were able to do, with the same technique, soy sauce with a little bit of gelatin, and at the end becomes like a pork rind, like a fried pork rind.
Wow,
if
weird.
I put the pork rind next to this new soy, you don't know which one is which. That's how amazing this is. But how we did it? Because we were not afraid of failure. The worst thing you can do in life is being afraid of failure. And that's what happened in Puerto Rico. We had too many people afraid of failure,
yeah.
Afraid of breaking the rules. You can never be afraid of breaking the rules if you can be improving something.
Jose Andres, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Jose Andres has a new book called We Fed an Island about his relief efforts in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shirok, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.